Hello, and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host is Sam Wong.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So things are getting even crazier in Washington, if that's even possible. Lots of different stories are converging this week, so we thought we could take a few minutes to talk a little bit about what's going on. Obviously, more special elections are happening, and the Democrats are starting to get some at least look at what their candidate pool might look like. The elections this week and the primaries have led to some commentary of the potential diversifying of the Democratic candidate pool. And at the same time, our president has really unleashed an all-out counter assault on the investigation that has consumed a lot of his presidency. He's picked up on the story about the FBI having an informant during the campaign to talk about not only what he's called a witch hunt, but also now using the term Spygate. He's had a meeting.
Oh, yes. He says it's all bigger than Watergate.
It's bigger than Watergate.
Which when I saw the headline, I thought, finally, he's coming around to.
but you know, it's a for many commentators, this is it's beyond the tweets. He's actually now meeting with the Justice Department. He's insisting on an investigation into the investigators. And this is a pretty muscular use of presidential power about an on an investigation that involves him. I don't know. I thought it would be interesting this week just to try to step back and not just do the ins and outs of the scandal, but what is all this doing politically? Where is this going? How's this going to affect just midterms, his presidency? And I think I'm not clear anymore on where this all goes.
Well, first,
what do you think?
Can we tell whether he's actually doing very much? Because if you look at his public schedule, he seems to spend a lot of time like with executive time and sitting around not doing a whole lot. And I'm wondering whether this tweet, whereas he sends out a tweet saying, I hereby request that the Department of Justice look into, you know, this burrowing into my campaign. Are there fewer barriers between him and doing that at the level of, say, his lawyers and so on? Or his lawyers and also the White House lawyer?
Well, I have no idea. We've had different accounts of both how he tweets, how much other advisors are involved in doing some of the tweets. You've talked about that at one point over the past few months. And it's always hard to distinguish when he is out of control versus when it's actually a controlled response to try to shape the conversation. Look, legislation actually passed yesterday.
Weakening Dodd-Frank?
Weakening Dodd-Frank.
That wasn't him, though. That's
no,
Congress.
That's Congress. But I'm saying things are happening in Washington. And so one way to look at – there's one narrative about the last week, which is he is, as we hear every week, spinning out of control. He's angry. He's just lashing out. Another is this is a pretty systematic attack on this investigation, and it's not simply an effort to distract, but he wants to poison the water, so to speak, in terms of how we think of what all this is. It's now a story that we're hearing about that is also about what did the FBI do politically back under President Obama.
Well, one way to look at this is that there are these levels of professionalism that suffuse our national culture, our national government, whether it be Rod Rosenstein at the FBI or White House Counsel Don McGahn, these people who have rules of conduct that tell them, look, the president isn't supposed to interfere with the Department of Justice, or look, as a lawyer to the White House Counsel, in the case of McGahn, I can't lie, things like that. And so there are these rules of engagement that people around him are following. And, you know, he's this guy who showed up who, you know, he's basically a Fox News viewer brought to life and given a few $100 million or however tens of millions of dollars he actually has. And he gets up there and he doesn't know his way around, but he knows how to get people's attention. And so he's, and you know, is it is what's happening now that he's finally getting his hands on the levers of how to manipulate things. Another question that comes to my mind is, are these professionals holding the line? Like Rod Rosenstein said that something along the lines of, we'll look into possible interference with campaigns. Was that just a degradation of standards at the FBI, or was it a way to keep Trump at bay to let the FBI do its work and to hold him off for maybe a few more months?
My sense is that he and others are trying to hold him off. I think Trump has discovered what you're not supposed to do doesn't mean you can't do.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of presidential politics where we always assumed, not we, but collectively, that the not supposed to was a rule or was an actual barrier. And I think he keeps testing that and exploiting that. And he's showing, you know, you can go pretty far. And so I don't know what the thinking is in the Justice Department, but my sense is there are people who are trying to contain, not a lot, but there are some who are trying to contain this, and they're making these kinds of compromises, or they're making these kinds of appeasing moves to try to hold him off rather than getting in a full-fledged crisis. But in terms of getting, I must say, I think this is having two effects that Democrats would want to be wary of. One, I do think he has put out a counter narrative that is influencing Republicans and certainly makes
– and not just rank and file Republicans, but officials. Like people who work in Congress, people who work maybe at – we don't know, but at the FBI or at the Department of Justice.
Exactly. And since in the end
– and describe that counter narrative.
Well, the counter narrative, it's pretty clear and it's pretty bold actually what he's saying. He is saying that Obama's law enforcement officials – were part of a political campaign. They were not just partisan, but they were spying on the campaign, trying to undermine the campaign for the Democratic candidate. And the other part of the narrative, if you add up...
They did an awesomely bad job, if everybody remembers.
Right, no, right. But I'm just saying the story. And we now know stories don't have to add up to facts or to a rational look at that. Since then, there's almost been an effort to undertake a coup through Robert Mueller, through James Comey, and that's the story he's telling. But most important, the story is this is not legitimate. This is it's made up, it's political. And my guess is that's out there enough that it's going to be a little harder politically, depending on what's in this report, to make a lot out of it.
I find this really bizarre because I'm thinking about a piece that came out last week by Adam Serwer over at The Atlantic saying that all these little stories about Michael Cohen getting money from the Russians or something having to do with, you know, Trump firing Comey and so on. And Serwer says that let's not lose track of the big story. And the big story is massive scale corruption and disregard for all the rules that the president and the presidency are supposed to be following. And, you know, and I don't know, one could maybe just draw a broad picture that some people might call it disruptive, but violating all the rules and norms of what the president is supposed to do is a pretty massive story, and it's one story. And so, I don't know, the role of propaganda is to not invalidate the truth, but to confuse the situation so it's hard to know what the truth is. And so if you come up with some massive, transparently ridiculous story like, the deep state is after me and Mueller's going to – I think Giuliani's claimed that Mueller's going to wrap up the investigation by September 1st. And so just this cloud of chaff of false statements, made-up statements, and journalists are still, I think, not quite up to saying the word lie. And that's a little rough because journalists, it just sounds pejorative to say the word lie.
I don't know if it would make a difference.
It might not make a difference.
I'm not sure it might make a difference. I think.
It might not make a difference.
Yeah. And so the next issue, so part of it is how does this affect the politics of the scandal and the investigation? And I definitely think we're in a state now where it's becoming more confused probably in the public mind than it was 6 months ago.
Yeah, because they've been getting this little drip of confusion, and eventually that drip starts collecting a little bit.
And then the other question is, so what does this do to the parties? We are going into midterm season. Summer's here. And when everyone gets back, it's full-time campaigning. That's what we're going to have from September to November. That's what happens in midterm years. And I am – there's more commentary I've been seeing about – kind of how does this affect the party competition? Will this dampen some of the enthusiasm? Are issues being overshadowed, whether it's corruption or whether it's economic issues, by these stories? And will this have some kind of real effect on the potential for a Democratic takeover or even for large Democratic gains as a minority?
Well, I feel like there's a couple of things going on here. One is that at a national level, Democrats are attempting to come out with a message that will actually be taken up by reporters or actually get reported. So, you know, the Democrats will sometimes come up with a message, but it doesn't necessarily resonate and have legs. And so their message is going to be this massive corruption will come to an end and will be finally or at least be investigated, right? So that's, that's one thing. And then the other is bread and butter, things like we're looking after your health care. We're looking out for you, and we are going to introduce things like whatever it might be, $15 minimum wage, doing something to strengthen health care. And so these are things that Democrats would like to talk about, and, you know, will that resonate? Another thing is we've been hearing over the last 12 months about grassroots energy, the women's movement, even things like scientists getting out and marching, things like the Indivisible movement. And at some level, we're at this turning point here at the beginning of summer. We're rolling into Memorial, you know, it's around Memorial Day, like this is when summer begins. And so the question is all that energy from people who haven't been involved in politics, is that going to keep going? Because at some level, there was this huge passion in the first 6 months, maybe in the first 12 months. So is that going to translate into actual action? Like, you know, here, let me just give you a very local example. Indivisible Princeton, right? That's an organization that in this area that rose up in response to the new administration. Are they going to get it together to get out the vote in, I don't know, Rocky Hill? Like how
same will, way they got went after repeal and replace legislation.
Right. So will that energy be maintained? And so there is some question, you know, and I don't know the answer. Like does national energy get turned into local action? And that has to get repeated, you know, hundreds of times across the United States in congressional elections and state elections. And so we're at this time where we're about to find out whether when the rubber hits the road, will these national events move things?
And that's going to be there's lots of discussions about Democratic enthusiasm and all the reasons Democrats are worked up and ready to vote. But I still suspect that there are certain constituencies in the GOP who are quite happy with what the president has done, and they are well organized. The gun rights lobby movement, anti-immigrant groups.
They've been good at it for decades.
No, I know. I'm saying, and evangelicals who are all pretty, they're pleased with what the president has delivered.
Right.
And I wouldn't discount what they can do in the next few months. I don't think they've really gotten started yet in terms of counteracting some of the anger enthusiasm that you see in the Democrats. So that could have a big effect, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, like one indicator I've been looking at is special elections. And so there's been this lot of talk among quantitative nerds about how in special elections, in something like 100 special elections since the Clinton versus Trump contest, Democrats have done about 13, 15 points better than Hillary Clinton did against Donald Trump. And so that's supposed to be part of a Democratic wave. But if you look over the last 3 months, that number has gone down. And if you look there, it's more like, you know, I have to, it depends on the exact time window. But if you look at, say, over the last 2 months, Democrats are about doing the same as Clinton versus Trump. And that is a very different story. And if so, the pattern of the last few months holds, that might indicate less enthusiasm than there was, say, 3 or 4 months ago. So we are in a period of not knowing what's going to happen. Will these national stories get turned into some kind of blue wave? You know, the blue wave, you know, what if it gets smaller? What if it's a ripple?
Yeah. And the national stories, I guess what I'm thinking is, can also depress enthusiasm. I mean, people can get tired of it, and it can be, I'm done. I don't want to see it anymore. I don't want to read about it anymore. Yeah. I'm tired of this.
Yeah.
And that could have an effect on a midterm where you need everyone really to be, I'm going to go vote at the school.
Right. So one way to diminish energy is to attack the other side. And so if the other side, if the Democrats start, I don't know, probably the right play at this point would be to start portraying Democrats as being corrupt.
Right.
Right. Or incompetent. That would be a good move.
A triangulation in elections.
Like in a negative, nihilistic form of triangulation.
And then the other story that's emerged right now is within the Democratic Party. The Intercept has been running a number of stories. I know you tweeted about this, and it's about how the Democratic leadership is clamping down on some primary challengers and trying to make sure that the safe candidate is the one who has the support needed for the general election. It didn't in the Tuesday yesterday. We're recording this on Wednesday. The Democratic leadership, I think, suffered a couple blows along those lines. I saw you tweeted when that article came out. I think it was the article about Steny Hoyer, that this is what parties do.
It is what parties do. Parties are like, sometimes they do it behind closed doors. Sometimes they do it with money. But the job of political parties is to exert some muscle and decide, okay, who would be a good official or not. And so, you know, there's all this, I've read this complaining about how the Democratic, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has been attempting to pick winners and losers. But, you know, isn't that like there's quality control that's done by political parties? And pardon my being a bit of an authority fan of authority, but what else are national parties for but to vet people who you and I are never going to meet in person?
I mean,
they know these people.
Yeah. The question, I hear you, and I understand that role of parties. But the question I think about, and I don't have an answer, is the party doing a good job picking candidates? And is their track record good enough that we – if you are a Democrat, would want to kind of delegate that authority? The counter argument, they haven't been picking well. The situation isn't so good, so maybe the leadership should be challenged. And the second issue that comes up, which is also interesting, is it maybe that the outsider candidates can actually generate more enthusiasm at this point in this turnout battle that's going to happen? Maybe they're the ones who can get away from the major narratives of corruption, scandal, counter-scandal. Is there anything to that, that the safer candidate won't do that? And come election time, it'll be hard for them to get people out as some of these insurgents, so to speak.
Well, there are new candidates coming in, as has been reported a few times in the press. We have the most women running for office ever in the history of the United States. One example that came out, I don't know which side the DCCC was on this one, but the Georgia Democratic primary for governor was won by, it was two women named Stacey running against each other, which is spelled the same way, Stacey. And so Stacey Abrams defeated Stacey Evans, I believe. And Stacey Abrams is this African-American woman. If she wins, she'll be the first African-American governor in the South. She very clearly has a pretty obvious claim to being an outsider and somebody pretty new. And I think that that's inevitable, that there are going to be a lot of fresh faces in Washington, no matter who takes over Congress. There's a wave of candidates, at least, who are now in the fray. And, you know, will the DCCC pick some of them or not? I couldn't say. But I think that at a grassroots level and at the level of candidates, there is something developing at a pretty fundamental level in U.S. politics.
And I think the organizational prowess that would be necessary to counter some of the tools I think Republicans are going to bring to the table in the midterms. And I do think people are underestimating what they're going to bring to the table, including money. It looks like the Koch brothers are gearing up. It looks like Sheldon Adelson's gearing up and many more of those funding sources.
Sure. They've adapted to the Trump reality.
They've right? adapted.
They didn't like him a whole lot, but now they think, okay.
Right. And they know how to play the midterm game.
Right.
But female voters, the issue of gender is one of the big fault lines with this administration. And there's been work. There was an article in Democracy by Theda Scotchpole and Laura Putnam how since the election in local communities around the country, college-educated women have not just been angry about Trump. They've been organizing. They've been doing some of the real grunt work that's necessary to get ready for midterms and make sure that people come out for a vote. There's been stories that some of the students from the Parkland movement are actually getting invested in the midterms. So I think more than are they angry about President Trump, those are probably
Can they turn it into action? Because many of these people are new to politics, like the 18-year-olds by definition. And the new wave of enthusiasm among women voters has been, you know, from being either on the sidelines or being normal voters to being activist voters. And there's this practical question of how somebody like that gets turned into someone who can, you know, get on the ground and get out there the way that, say, the Democratic Party organization has been good at, or the way that unions used to do. And of course, as unions have become weaker and weaker, there's this void on the left of exactly how one organizes, evidently not through unions as much as before, you know.
Yeah.
What, like Unitarians and Methodists? I mean, who's going to do this?
No. There's absolutely no – there's nothing that has replaced organized labor in the Democratic coalition. And I think since that weakened organized labor in the 70s, really declining dramatically in the 80s. Nothing's picked up for that. And then you have the added factor. If you have a triple screen, so to speak, you know, maybe one part of the screen is Russia and the Russia investigation. Middle part of the screen is the anger and outrage about President Trump's policies and his rhetoric beyond that. But then you also have the economy, which is doing well. And it doesn't look like there's going to be any significant reversal in the next few months. I don't know. Maybe.
Really?
Well, I'm not an economist, but that probably wouldn't help either. We can't look into the future. But if this continues, can't that also dampen some of what Democrats are going to be able to do? I mean, if this was a Democratic president running with this economy, don't you think most analysts would say things will be okay for the Democrats, even if they're going to lose seats as you usually do in midterms?
Well, the normal – let's see. So the, going to the topic of the economy.
Yeah.
Normal econometric models say the economy is doing okay, so maybe things wouldn't be too bad. But those normal models aren't quite so much predictions of what's going to happen, but they give you an over-under. And I think it's more appropriate, like, to use the parlance of betting and sports, an over-under for where things ought to be. And now you get to find out how valuable the party in power is, how valuable or, you know, how radioactive, how anti-valuable Trump is. And so, sure, the economy might say that the losses won't be so bad. And that gives us a context for understanding exactly how bad things are when you measure actual election results. So what I would do is separate broad macro conditions like the economy, which have some predictive power, from what voters are doing. And what voters are doing right now is, as of 3 or 4 months ago, they in special elections, they were going against Trump pretty hard. Trump was less popular. He's recovered somewhat in approval numbers. And in these special elections, Democrats are not quite doing so well as they were. And so we've got two indicators in the form of actual opinion and actual voting where things have moved in the Republicans' direction in the last 2 or 3 months. And so what I would say is, overall, things are worse for the Republicans than the economy might suggest. But, you know, things are moving a little bit in their direction. I'm looking here at my news feed, and there's this guy, Charlie Bilello. Who says that, you know, 1 year treasury yields are at the highest level they've been in 9 years. You know, commodities at the highest level in over 3 years. And so there are these extreme things that are happening. And I could not tell you whether that's going to lead to a breakpoint, but it sure looks like there's some pretty unusual, you know, winds blowing in the economy.
But you also have unemployment at a very low rate. I mean, of all the measures, this is probably the one that matters most to voters.
Because it affects actual people.
It affects actual people. And even if you're in a community where the rate is much higher than the national rate, it probably still matters to have that number circulating in communities. I mean, it is a low unemployment rate.
Right, right.
And so that can also have an effect. So Democrats need to, if we're thinking of how this plays out, there's some pretty formidable challenges to capitalize on what potentially could happen.
Well, they need to get all those, you know, all those right before the election in 2016, I saw banners go up, drain the swamp, end corruption. I don't know, maybe they can just get their banners from their Republican friends and say, okay, these are our banners now.
And then what do you think, say we don't know the midterm yet, but so what, back to our first question, what do you think is going to happen with this whole investigation? Like, where do you, what, I know you don't, well, you predict more than I do, but where do you see this playing out without knowing what's in this report, if it comes to a report?
Well, the scuttlebutt is that, I mean, just to point out the obvious to people who have not been paying close attention, unlike other investigations like Whitewater or other scandals of the past, this is an investigation that's led to a dozen and a half indictments so far, and surely more indictments on the way, and something like 5 convictions. And so already the investigation, unlike any other high-profile investigation we've heard of in the last 10, 15 years, this is an investigation that's led to indictments. It's led to convictions. So I don't know. I would say that the past is a predictor of the future. And so past performance is looking like Mueller is headed towards several dozen indictments. That's going to lead to convictions. It's going to lead to some kind of report. Presumably, he's going to come up with some kind of recommendation about whether a sitting president can be indicted either criminally or for, you know, or for civil offenses. If the answer for criminal is no, then it's a political remedy. And then that turns into the question of, okay, who's going to control Congress after November? So I think it's pretty clear that this investigation is leading to more indictments and convictions. I think that's obvious.
Yeah.
Does it turn into some kind of long-lasting, you know, spectacle and car crash at the national level? Almost certainly depends on who has the power of investigation.
Well, it could be like Iran-Contra, which was a major investigation. Many people were caught up, but in the end, it didn't have the political effect. I mean, you could argue Iran-Contra was bigger.
Reagan ended not very popular.
He ends popular. His popular at the very end is going up.
Towards the end, like
post
at the very
INF
end. But during
Iran-Contra,
his popular was
it plummets. Yeah. It has the largest, I think, single month fall since they recorded it. But it will go up the following year, and it doesn't bring down his presidency. Democrats back away from doing anything about it, even at its worst. So that's something else to think about.
But Iran-Contra was, in some sense, contained. I mean, it was important because it was foreign policy, and it was basically, you know, buying arms from one enemy and then arming rebels in another country. So, but at the same time, it was foreign policy. Whereas I would say that the apparent corruption in the Trump administration is part of who they are. It's at the core of who they are, whether it be dealing with Russians, whether it be with corruption of, you know, abuse of the powers of government, obstruction of justice. This is not Iran-Contra. This is who they are. It's fundamentally who Donald Trump is. And so I think it's different in that regard. Just the substance is different. Not to be all substantive on you, but the substance is actually different.
Could be. I mean, the argument at the time was pretty big about Reagan. I mean, the argument was this was how Reagan conducted his foreign policy. He didn't care about what Congress had to say. He didn't care about laws, and he didn't care about restraints on the presidency. The big difference is that was, for many Republicans and Democrats, a patriotic objective that this was being used for. That's why Ollie North becomes a hero, meaning
he's the head of the NRA.
He was right. That's an incredible story, isn't it?
Yes.
But he was fighting communism where the Congress was falling down on the job, whereas this story is more probably about corruption on faith. It's harder to make that kind of claim unless he twists it into this present heroically fighting the deep state, which is a kind of, this is his communism.
This is the new
this
slogan.
This is his enemy. And I don't think, I think there is a narrative that he's going to try to push.
State.
Yeah, the deep state is the danger to the country. And he's the one who's taking it on.
This is the national, what I would call the national level rule of law.
Right.
I know it's not very catchy.
Yeah. But the question is, how do these two things converge? Meaning, is this simply irrelevant to what's going to happen in the next, you know, 5 months going toward the election? Or is this something that's actually going to have an effect? Assuming there's no indictment right now before the midterms, or there's no move for impeachment, obviously, or it's not resolved in a way that absolves him.
But just keep in mind that so far through all this, despite anything that has appeared in the news, Mueller has actually been silent except through the indictments and convictions. And so what that means is it's been a one-sided telling of the story in which all we've heard is this railing against this mysterious figure who is part of the deep state. And we don't actually know any particulars. And I guess I'm at this point, I'm not sure whether I'm expressing a hope or a speculation or what, but surely the actual specificity of a report is going to have some impact on the national conversation. Maybe.
Could, although if you think of
Or it's going to just like disappear in a few days.
Well, think about campaigns. People always say whoever controls the story first, whoever controls the narrative first often is the winner, and that you can come out later with a good argument, but it might be too late. That's always how I think politicians now look at the situation. Can it be the same this way, that by the time Mueller's report comes out, his story, the president's version, might have already won or be more powerful.
I thought Mueller's job was to bring indictments and bring convictions in a court of law, and I thought that judges were supposed to look at the cases in front of them. So isn't that a different story?
Well, the judges might be Congress, and if this isn't handled in a court, in the end, it's really what does Congress want to do with all this?
Politicians. Yeah, but we know where Congress is, which is that it's composed of these national parties that, for good or bad, well, I know which of those I think, but anyway, they reflect the wishes of their rank and file voters, and so right now, Republicans in Congress have adopted a pretty clear position that except for maybe a handful of them, they are not interested in rocking the boat in terms of who their president is. They don't want to have a President Pence or whatever. Yeah.
What do you think of the idea of Democrats honing in on corruption as a theme? That's the theme for the fall. Do you think that's a good idea?
It has, as Henry Kissinger once said to President Nixon,
yes,
a person in whom you are expert, Kissinger said, tell this story. It has the additional advantage of being true. And so if Democrats were to hone in on corruption, it would have the advantage of being true. It has the disadvantage of turning the question of corruption into a partisan issue where one side says corruption, the other side says, aha, you're after me.
Yeah.
Right. And so then in the public eye, you know, voters don't necessarily do a very good job of distinguishing partisan warfare from actual truth versus
And do you think that's an issue that could address the potential problem Democrats face of keeping the enthusiasm and keeping groups like Indivisible actually getting ready for election?
Right. What gets voters riled up and angry? Right. Well, the things they got riled up and angry about, well, you know, healthcare is still in there.
Yeah.
But it seems to have diminished somewhat in people's minds, even if it's as important as before. So, you know, I think corruption, you know, good question. Is it enough to move voters to the polls? It might be enough to depress Republican turnout. If the message gets through on the Republican side, they may be less enthusiastic about their guy. Because, you know, like all it takes is differential turnout. Even if minds are not changed, all it takes is for Republican voters to say, yeah, I'm not quite as excited as I was. I still like the guy, but I don't know. I just can't quite get it together to go vote. And that's, you know, only even if it's only a few percentage points, that could make a difference.
It's unclear to me. Genuinely, I'm not sure how this will play out politically. There's part of me that, and it's based on absolutely nothing empirical, that there could be a level of fatigue that sets in after the summer's over. And that if this is all Democrats have as their issue, they might do okay just because of how midterms go, but I don't think they're necessarily going to capture a lot of the sentiment that's been out there for over a year now. I'm not sure.
I see. So it has to be something like protect health care, increase in the minimum wage.
I think there has to be some issues.
Go after corruption, something like that.
I don't know. Right. I think there has to be. And part of it isn't about corruption. It's been there's so much about corruption that it doesn't get you to open your eyes at this point. You know, the comparison everyone is making, or not everyone, one person made, is the 2006 midterms where Democrats retook control of Congress and corruption became a major theme. There were a number of scandals that year involving a lobbyist named Jack Abramoff, who had all kinds of ties to the Republican leadership, and Tom DeLay and Mark Foley, a legislator who was texting with pages. And there were all these scandals that I remember at the time of the election were in the end seen as responsible for the outcome. But again, that election, Democrats had a huge, giant issue in addition to corruption, and that was Iraq and the way the war had unfolded. So that was looming on everyone's mind. And I guess the question is there something comparable now to complement the anger about corruption and the anger about scandal? And I don't know.
Well, you know, that was an 11-point swing from 2004 to 2006. The national margin between Democrats and Republicans swung by 11 points towards Democrats from 2004 when Iraq was an issue, but there's this sort of this residual bit of love left over for Bush from 9/11. And then that turned against him by 2006. Post-Katrina as well.
Yes, post-Katrina, so there were several things that revelations about enhanced interrogation.
Yeah, so the wheels came off on the Bush administration in a really visible way in that two-year period, and that was an 11-point swing. And so, you know, Republicans won the national popular vote at the level of Congress by 1.1 percentage points a year and a half ago. And so if things swung 11 points, that would be enough to retake Congress for the Democrats.
Right.
That would be enough. And so that much swing is certainly enough, or almost certainly enough, for control of Congress to switch. And then the question is, well, are we going to see a swing that large?
Well, we'll see. I do think the politics of this isn't as clear as some people believe. And I think it becomes murkier going into the summer. And I do feel like we're at some political crossroads. in terms of where this story is going. But I hear from the deep state that it's time to wrap up our show in my earphone. So that's it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Politics and Polls. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify, and we will be back soon.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.